Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, or ADHD, affects an estimated 8 to 10% of school-aged children in the United States. It's one of the most studied disorders in medicine. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. ADHD is also one of the most controversial disorders in medicine. When a child is diagnosed with ADHD, parents have some difficult choices to make. Today, we'll find out more about what it is. We'll talk about the different methods for helping a child and that child's family cope with the disorder. And we'll start the hour with the story of a little boy named Nathan. We also want to hear from you. Join our conversation after the news. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. Today we're going to talk about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's estimated that the disorder affects 8 to 10% of all children in the United States. It's one of the most studied disorders in medicine and one of the most controversial. Later this hour, I'll talk with child psychiatrist Dr. Chadi Kalarje and Beth Troutman. But first, Shannon Crone is a mother of two. She lives in Marion. Her younger child, Nathan, struggled with behavior problems from an early age and was diagnosed with ADHD when he was six. She's agreed to be with us today to tell us her story. Shannon, what were some of the behaviors that Nathan was exhibiting that made you think that you needed to ask for help?
His impulsivity was becoming such a problem that he was throwing chairs at other children in daycare, throwing blocks, hurting other people. And the biggest red flag was him actually getting out of his car seat at the time and throwing his car seat at me on Interstate 380.
How old was he when you started seeing this kind of stuff?
Pretty much once he could start walking, he would get really frustrated and he would start swinging his arms around trying to hit people.
Now, of course, a lot of people talk about the terrible twos and the tantrums that 2 and 3 year olds go through. At what point did you think this isn't normal?
He just didn't seem to ever get out of them. I mean, the terrible twos turned into the terrible threes and the terrible fours. And when he was 4 years old, I went back to work full time. I'd been a stay-at-home mom for 7 years, all of his life. And he just did not adjust to the change well at all. I would have to literally restrain him in the front seat, which he had already unbuckled, and crawled into the front seat while I'm driving a mile to his daycare. I'm holding him down. He's trying to grab the brake while I'm driving.
And where did you turn for help when you decided that it was time?
Well, we had already been referred to the Grantwood Agency by his preschool daycare. So we had started that process, but then it was getting so bad that he was acting out every week for 6 weeks. Finally, he actually was asked to leave. So then we went to our pediatrician and he said, "You are a family in crisis. If you don't get this taken care of now, you will be visiting your son in Four Oaks down the road." And he said, "He's got signs of ADHD.
So once your pediatrician said that, what did you go through to get him evaluated?
Well, we had already started the process with Grantwood. I actually had left my job because he didn't have daycare anymore. So I ended up having to quit my full-time job. And she came to our house and evaluated him. Then we were referred to the University of Iowa for an evaluation. In the meantime, we actually started the IEP process, the Individual Education Plan. And he had an IEP going into kindergarten before he'd even been to the school.
And your pediatrician had said that he showed signs of ADHD, but as you went into the evaluation process, what were some of the other things that you were concerned about?
I was concerned that he was acting aggressively towards his sister and his parents. I was concerned that he was acting aggressively towards our cats. He actually did toss one. The cat was okay, but he had picked up the cat and tossed it across the room. He just was very destructive. He didn't care. I remember one time he threw a toy at my face and made me cry, and he just laughed. And he's a very sweet boy. He has a great sense of humor. He's very loving and caring, but then he can also be, you know, not so caring. He kind of is the Jekyll and Hyde story.
And were you feeling certain that it was ADHD, or were there other possibilities in your mind?
I was thinking Asperger's. And I was really shocked when he said ADHD, because I thought, how did I miss this? I grew up around it.
Right.
I mean, my brother didn't have the hyperactivity part diagnosed, but I always felt he was hyperactive. And my parents felt that the ADD was the school's problem and not his.
So once you started going through the evaluation process, you found out a lot of things about Nathan, right?
Yes. Yes. He is, he's smart. He's very smart. He did an IQ test at the age of almost six, and he scored 132. He's in the 99th percentile in nonverbal. In the verbal, then he's in the 10th percentile. He's got a huge range of discrepancy.
And that probably gave you a lot of insight, not only into the fact that there was a lot going on in his head, but also how frustrating it must have been for him to not have those communication skills.
Yes. And also one thing he struggles with and he gets help for is a speech. His speech, he's got the R problem that a lot of kids have. And he just has a hard time expressing himself. And if you ask him, even to this day, to repeat himself, he'll get very frustrated. But he couldn't communicate his frustration other than acting out physically.
After you got the diagnosis of ADHD, what were the possibilities for treatment that you were presented with?
Behavior modification isn't really something that I think would work in our circumstance, because at that point we were scared of our son. We were scared for our daughter's safety, and we were scared for his safety. So we were given the prescription for the Ritalin, and my husband said, you know, let's think about it. So we walked out into the parking lot, and he got in his car, and I went to say goodbye, and I said, what are we waiting for? You know, we are a family in crisis. We're falling apart because we were fighting all the time. So I went right back in and said, let's do the Ritalin, and we started it the next day.
So you started giving him Ritalin. How quickly did you notice a difference?
I'd say the next day he became worse. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is not what I wanted. And probably 3 days into it, I started noticing that it was getting better.
Once he started responding to the Ritalin and you felt like it was working, what did you see change in his behavior that made you feel like it was working?
Well, I didn't see the aggression as much. One thing with the Ritalin is that he gets two doses and they last 4 hours each. So even now, you know, he's seven, the evenings are really rough. We see it starts out with him starting to talk about butts all the time. And just you notice that his everyday conversation is butt, butt, butt. And then he starts getting hyper.
When it got to be time for kindergarten, how long had he been on medication before the school year would have started?
4 months.
How were you feeling about sending him to kindergarten?
I was scared. And the reason why is we went in with this IEP, and they ask, what level of special education do you want your kid to have? There's the behavior modification room, which is at a whole other school, where that was be all he would be in, and he would be labeled right away. Then there was the he can go to the room at the school for a certain time during the day, or there's they'll just keep an eye on him. I was nervous. I mean, I pretty much sat by my phone that first day because I thought for sure we'd get a phone call.
And which route did you choose?
We went with the least amount of intervention. He got speech therapy, and then the special ed teacher would come and check on him once in a while, but that would be all.
Do you talk with him about the problem that he has and what you're doing to help him cope with it?
Yeah, he's been taking the pills religiously fairly well. But there's times where I say, Nathan, you need to take this pill so you can be the best Nathan that you can be. And one time we were watching a cartoon and he's like, hey, look at that cartoon character. He's just hyper like I am, you know. So he knows that, you know, he acts differently sometimes. But the drawback is we call it the drug haze. Probably about an hour into taking this pill, he's just kind of spacing out a little bit. So we feel bad, you know, when we see that. But then we see him in the evening. And the days, you know, where he doesn't get his pill in time, and then we're like, oh my God, thank God for Ritalin.
So you didn't get a call on that first day of school?
No.
How did kindergarten go?
Went great. He did excellent. He excelled, and the teacher loved him. They were very patient with him. I would get an email here or there, you know, Nathan had a rough day. This is how he worked it out. But they just loved him.
He's in first grade now?
Yes.
How's this year going?
We've had some rough bumps. He really loved his first or his kindergarten teacher. Because first grade is a lot more writing intensive, and that is hard for him, the writing and the concentrating. So even with the medication, it's difficult for him.
So look into the future now. I'm sure a couple of years ago, it was very frightening to look into the future when thinking about Nathan. What does the future look like when you think about it now?
I'm scared about the future because I grew up with a brother who has ADD. He made choices partly spurred on by my parents not believing it was a medical issue and more a school issue. He ended up dropping out of school and getting into drugs and alcohol at a very young age. So even though we're raising Nathan differently, I do worry that he'll come to a point where he'll think, I don't need these pills, and then he'll turn to something else. But I'm so hopeful that he's going to be a football player, and he's going to be popular, and he's going to have friends, and he's never going to leave home, and because he's my boy. I'm really hopeful for him. I hope he doesn't have to be on Ritalin forever. I hope that he's able to find a way to manage it by himself. But until he can, we're going to rely on the medication and, of course, just the way we treat him.
Knowing that your parents, for example, didn't believe in ADD when your brother was struggling with some of these same issues, there are people who don't believe in medicating children. How do you feel when you hear people talk about that?
I feel like we each make the best decision we can for our child. Don't judge me. We're doing the best we can with him. We want him to have friends. We want him to have a fair chance at getting an education. If this is what we have to do to help him get it, I mean, would you not give a diabetic insulin? It's not that he watches too much TV or eats too much red dye. It's the fact that his neurons, his neuromotor transmitters don't work the same as everyone else's.
There are other parents out there right now where you were a couple of years ago dealing with some pretty scary stuff and not knowing what way to turn. What would you tell them? What do you wish someone had told you?
That it wasn't my fault. It is what it is. The best thing to do is to reach out for help. Contact your kid's school. Contact your kid's doctor. And if you're in the Cedar Rapids area, check out the TIES program at St. Luke's. It's free, and it's helps parents and kids, you know, the behavior modification in addition to medication if you go that route. But you're not alone.
Shannon, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Shannon Crone is a mother of two. We've been talking about her son, her younger child, Nathan, and his struggle with ADHD and her struggle as a parent. We're going to continue our conversation about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We've mentioned this before, but it is a very common disorder. 8 to 10% of all children in the United States, it's estimated, are affected by the disorder. It's also extraordinarily controversial. We're going to talk right now with two doctors. Dr. Shadi Kalarje is a child psychologist and associate professor of psychology at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Hello, Dr. Kalarje.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And also with us is Dr. Beth Troutman. She's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. And she focuses her research on PCIT, parent-child interaction therapy. And we'll get into the specifics of what that is a little bit later on. Hello, Dr. Troutman.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here. And I want to start with some of the basics. So we hear ADHD talked about a lot. We hear it thrown around. A lot of people like to diagnose children they don't know with it and say, oh, that child has ADHD. So it's something that has entered into the common vernacular. We hear it a lot. But what exactly is it? And Dr. Kalarje, do you want to start?
Yeah. We follow, at least in psychiatry, the definition set by the American Psychiatric Association, And that can be found in what we call the DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual. The last edition was revised kind of in 2000. And ADHD is a disorder. And I want to kind of clarify that most of the symptoms that I'm going to go over are present almost in every person, you know, among us. But it becomes a disorder when it reaches a set or a number of symptoms threshold where it crosses from being normal to actually interfering with the child's functioning in general. And these symptoms are split in two big groups. Inattention, and that includes lack of attention, distractibility, inability to complete tasks, forgetfulness or needing reminders to complete tasks, rushing through things, carelessness, misplacing things, and so forth. And the other group includes impulsivity and hyperactivity, kind of lumped together. And they include fidgeting, restlessness, jumping over furniture, obviously in places where actually it's not appropriate, like in school or at church, talking too much, being loud, not being able to wait one's turn, interrupting people, especially parents or teachers in the classroom, and so forth. And the symptoms have to be present for a period of time because, you know, we've all as parents suspect that we've all seen kids behave different than themselves when they're ill or when there is stress. But the symptoms have to be present for a minimum of 6 months for a diagnosis to be made. And again, impairment has to be present. And by impairment, I mean whether learning problems or social problems or aggression like we've seen with Nathan.
Right, and we were talking about Nathan's case, and he has a very serious case of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The symptoms that you were talking about, like you said, all of us express those symptoms at one time or another, and especially kids. Kids do get a little crazy and act out sometimes. So what are some of the telltale signs that will get or wind up in a doctor's office, you know, wind up with a child heading to the doctor's office? Dr. Troutman, do you want to address that?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things in hearing this is real typical of what I see with the kids that I see, and that parents often recognize it first. And so it sounded like at the age of two, she already saw that he was not a typical two-year-old. And when she talked about him getting kicked out of daycare, I mean, that's, to me, a pretty good sign of impairment when a child gets kicked out of a daycare for their behavior. So I think a lot of times parents just have to keep sort of looking for answers and looking for help because often they see that their child is acting differently than other kids.
All right. When a child is either when a teacher says, I think your child has a problem, when the daycare center, I think, says, I think your child has a problem, or when a parent says, okay, we really need help with this issue, and they end up heading to the pediatrician, what happens next?
So at that point, the pediatrician will, you know, ask the questions very similar to what we've heard Shannon talk about. Ideally, they would not just ask the parents questions, but obtain at least forms or questionnaires. And there are a number of them well studied and validated that can be sent to school to obtain the feedback from the teachers. And then if there are other sources of information, like if the kid goes to, say, a daycare after school, then additional, the more information you have to make a diagnosis based on different environments, based on different contingencies, then the more valid and accurate your diagnosis will be.
And once the diagnosis is made, then what happens?
Typically, I mean, it largely depends on what the parents would like to see. And while I agree Nathan's case is really atypical of what we see, it might be a little kind of on the extreme side, certainly not, you know, the extreme of what we've seen, but I just would like, I hope, I guess, later on, maybe in the program, we kind of discuss how not every child with ADHD has to be aggressive to have ADHD. But again, back to your question, depending on what the parents are interested in, then a plan is formulated, whether they're interested in medications, whether they're interested in accommodations made at school or at home. Naturally, we would like to encourage parents to seek behavioral interventions. And I'd like to also point out that by doing this, we're not judging parents or blaming them for their behavior, just like you wouldn't blame, using Shannon's example, you wouldn't blame a parent for their child developing type 1 diabetes or problem with blood sugar, but the parent's role in modifying the diet at home to make sure there is best control of the blood sugar is important. And it's kind of in a similar way, it's important for the parents to modify the way they do things at home to be able to target and control the ADHD symptoms to the best extent possible.
So you're saying that, that when behavioral modification is suggested, it's not saying that the parenting techniques you've been using are wrong or bad, but these are techniques that can help with a child with ADHD. And of course, Dr. Troutman, that's where your research focuses.
Right, exactly. And I'm glad you made that point that we don't recommend behavior modification or changes in parenting because we think it's the parent's fault, more that we think that the parent can be the solution, that by finding different ways of reacting to their child, that they can get the best possible behavior out of their child.
We're talking about ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, today, and my guests are Dr. Shadi Kalarje. He's a child psychiatrist and associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. He focuses his research on the safety of psychiatric medicines in children, so we'll talk about that in just a moment. Also with me is Dr. Beth Troutman. She's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa College of Medicine, and she focuses her research on PCIT, Parent-Child Interaction Therapy, so behavioral modification to deal with ADHD. And you're welcome to join our conversation today. If this is something you've had experience with in your family, perhaps you have been diagnosed with ADHD, this is something you grew up with, or maybe you're a parent whose child has gone through this, we'd like to hear your story today and how you coped with it. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And first, I do want to talk about the pharmaceutical options for treating ADHD. This is not a, we're not making a recommendation by talking about that first, but that's where we're going to start right now. So we hear a lot about Ritalin, of course. That's another part of this phenomenon that has entered the popular lexicon, that we hear about Ritalin a lot. But what are the medications that can help a child with ADHD?
So there are different classes or groups of drugs, and Ritalin is part of the largest and most prescribed, the best studied group of drugs called psychostimulants or stimulants. And they include two subfamilies, if you will. One is the Ritalin family, and Ritalin is one of them. It's, as Shannon said, it's short-acting, meaning it lasts in the body for just a few hours. And oftentimes people have to use it at least twice, sometimes three times daily. Other medications within that subfamily include Concerta or Metadate or Focalin. All they have the same essentially active ingredient or different, like, variation of it, and that is methylphenidate or Ritalin.
And you mentioned it's a stimulant.
Yes.
That seems to be a little bit of counterintuitive to a lot of people, yeah, that you take a child who has a hard time controlling themselves and then give them a stimulant. You don't usually give a child sugar or caffeine when they seem to be having trouble controlling themselves. So how does a stimulant help a child with this disorder?
Right. The stimulant might be a little bit of a misnomer, or it might mislead people. And I wouldn't, you know, emphasize too much the name itself. It's just that's how the group of the medication is called. And I think I guess to answer more directly your question, how do these medications exactly work? We don't know. But what we do know is that These medications in general alter how dopamine, which is a neurochemical in the brain that's widely distributed, very important for attention and behavioral control, so they promote its release in between different brain cells or neurons to allow better communication, if you will.
And when medication is given, how quickly do parents start to see a change?
Yeah. This is a great question, and I think Shannon kind of also addressed it briefly. It depends on what medication. So I mentioned quickly the psychostimulants. The other group is dextroamphetamine, like Adderall. Many people have heard of Adderall. But there are non-stimulant medications like blood pressure medications called guanfacine or clonidine, and then tamoxetine or Strattera, and there are yet other groups of medications. So it depends on what medication we're talking about. For stimulants in general, you can see an effect literally within half an hour to an hour because they work very fast, and their efficacy disappears very fast as well. For other medications like the blood pressure medications I mentioned or atomoxetine, Strattera, they take a few days and sometimes a couple of weeks.
We have an email from Carolyn and Spencer. She says, my youngest son has ADHD and was medicated from age 6 to 17. While he's not outgrown ADHD, his coping mechanisms are much better now. He recognizes his weaknesses and is able to find ways to work around them. My only concern, and she says hindsight is 20/20, is the long-term effects of these medications, Concerta, Adderall, Ritalin, et cetera. Since many of the first-generation children treated with these meds are becoming adults, are researchers discovering any concerns? And that is your field of research. So are we concerned about the long-term effects of these medicines?
Yeah, we certainly are. And these psychostimulants, some of them have been on the market for 40, 50, and 60 years. And people have been studying both their safety in terms of brain development, but also on the body in general. And it's just methodologically, it's very difficult to answer these questions. I'd say at this point, we have a reasonable amount of evidence that these, especially psychostimulants like Ritalin and Adderall, tend to suppress growth by around a pound a year and half an inch a year. But then this can, if we determine that it's affecting a particular child enough, then there are things that could be done, either switching medications or stopping it on weekends or during vacations. We don't routinely recommend this because there is a cost to doing this in terms of the behavior returning. There are ways to address those. A few years ago, there was a concern that stimulants can increase blood cancer, but then many studies after that were done, and they determined that that's actually not a real concern. In terms of the effect on the brain, the few studies that are out there have suggested that, if anything, it's a positive long-term effect. But as I said, it's very difficult to tell what is the illness, the underlying illness, what that is causing to the brain versus the treatment. And there are efforts to do these kind of studies in animals to try to answer some of these questions. But naturally, the phenomenon is different. You cannot study ADHD in animals like you would with humans.
One of the places that the controversy over ADHD really comes into play is the fact that Ritalin, Adderall, these drugs can increase focus for anybody who takes them. And there is a very powerful black market in these kind of drugs. And you find among college students that kids with a diagnosis of ADHD and and their access to these drugs, they may be sharing them with friends or selling them to friends. So one of the places that the controversy comes in is that some people think that there are people who want these drugs for their kids just to make them better students. So how do you know that a child needs this and won't just benefit from it?
Do you want to start, Beth, and then I might add something if I feel...
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that's a tough, hard one.
Yeah, that's a tough question.
I mean, I think it is hard to tell, you know, when they need it versus cognitive enhancement is a term that's been used. And I mean, I must say that in our setting, we don't run into that very much because usually by the time kids get to psychiatry, it's pretty clear that it's really interfering with their functioning and that they really need it. But, so I imagine that that's an issue that people in other settings probably have to deal with more than we do.
I have to say the kids you're talking about are the most challenging clinically because oftentimes they've gone for years being just fine, perhaps getting B's, maybe, you know, A minuses, and then they get to college. It is a little bit more difficult. It's less structured than school, and so their grades slipped a little bit, and so they want, you know, to get back to their A's and B's. And yet there is no obvious impairment or severe impairment like we've seen with Nathan. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of the gray zone kids, and that's where I think the collaboration with the parents, but also with other providers like neuropsychologists, for example, or psychologists who can do some testing can be very useful.
We're talking about ADHD today, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. We're going to take a quick break here. My guests are Dr. Beth Troutman. She's a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa College of Medicine, and Dr. Shadi Kalarje. He's a child psychologist and professor of psychology also at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. 8 to 10% of children in the United States are estimated to be affected with this disorder. We've been talking about some of the medical interventions that can be taken, and now we're going to focus on behavioral modification. And we also welcome you into the conversation at 866-780-9100. We have number of callers on the line. We'll be getting to you in just a moment. My guests right now are Dr. Beth Troutman and Dr. Shadi Kalarje. And Dr. Troutman, I want to focus on you right now because I know your main area of research is on PCIT, parent-child interaction therapy. And this is a behavioral modification therapy. And in many ways, it's a behavioral modification therapy for the adults in a child's life.
That's right. Yeah.
Tell me what you do when someone comes to you with a child with ADHD, how do you work with the family?
And one of the things that I should point out is that, I mean, most of the time, the kids who are referred to me, it's for the behavior problems that go along with ADHD. So the majority of kids that I see also have ADHD, but the therapy is often focused on the fact that they tend not to comply with doing what adults tell them to do, and that they tend to be aggressive or, you know, pick on their siblings, things like that. So it's more the associated problems than the core symptoms of ADHD that we're working on. So initially what we do is we just work with parents in terms of teaching them what we call play therapy skills. And so they spend 5 minutes a day having a positive interaction with their child. Because as you can imagine, one of the things that happens when you have a child who has ADHD is that as a parent, you're spending all day paying attention to all the problems. So all day you're, you know, like, don't do that. Don't pick up the cat. Don't poke your sister. And so first thing we do is to try to help them have a positive relationship again by having 5 minutes in which we sort of set things up for the child to be well-behaved and to do well.
And you also, you work with the parents and the child in the clinic with a one-way mirror. So they're in a room, they can't see you, but you can see them. What do you do in that setting?
So the way it works is, as you said, there's a one-way mirror, and I'm behind the mirror, and the parent has a bug in there, what we call it a bug in the ear. It's actually like a Bluetooth. Mm-hmm. And then I'm behind the mirror sort of giving them tips on pointing out things that the child is doing well that they can praise, and then having them describe what the child is doing. So one of the things that we find with kids with ADHD is if you just describe what they're doing, it slows them down enough that they can actually have more sustained attention.
So give me an example of that.
So like the first time kids come in, they will be like going from toy to toy to toy, checking everything out. And then you have their parents describe like, oh, you're putting the two pieces of track together. You're putting the train on the track. I mean, it sounds very boring, very simple. But what happens is that you see these kids sort of slow down and go, oh, I am putting the track together. And all of a sudden, they will spend like 50 minutes playing with the same toy because their parent has just been focusing on describing what they're doing and sort of giving them what they don't have, which is that kind of internal monologue or ability to focus.
And how can a parent take that home? Because being in a small room where mm-hmm.
yes.
you are entirely focused on your child is very different from being at home with the phone ringing and with dinner to be made and bills to be paid and cleaning to be done and all of the things that will be distracting you at home.
And, I mean, one of the things I like about this therapy is that we set what I think are pretty realistic goals because we say for 5 minutes a day, do this with your child. You know, you cannot, yes, like you said, you cannot go home and do this all the time. But if you do it for 5 minutes a day, you will just, the parent will get better at noticing when the child is behaving well, and the child will start to point out when they're behaving instead of pointing out that they're being naughty.
And can 5 minutes of positive interaction with your child a day really affect how that child copes with school and all of the other things?
There is research indicating that it helps with performance at school. It doesn't help as much. And there's huge variability in terms of how much at school. So what we call the effect sizes in terms of how much the intervention helps, the effect sizes are huge at home. They're good at school. They're not as good. And so often we have to do other interventions at school to supplement.
And, of course, you know, at home the child is interacting with the parents who have been trained in this. At school and in other parts of life, they're interacting with teachers and the person out at recess and the people in the lunchroom and all kinds of different people. Are there ways that you can take this kind of therapy and integrate it into a classroom?
Yeah, Shannon, I think it was, the mom talked about an IEP, which is an individualized education plan. And that's a real important piece a lot of times for kids with ADHD is to have a plan of how you're going to address these things at school. And so you can integrate some of these things into the IEP.
All right. We have a lot of people on the line who want to talk about their experiences. This is Paula on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Hi. Now, your son was diagnosed with ADHD when he was 9 years old?
And he's now 45.
All right. When he was 9 years old and got that diagnosis, what did you do?
We worked with the school. We worked with the Linn County Mental Health Agency. It was the Grantwood Area Education Agency who did the testing and referred him to psychiatric assistance. They had a parent support group for parents of children with ADHD. We met with a psychologist monthly. He would meet with them. Then we would meet with the psychologist and work on plans, parenting skills, positive reinforcement, which is critical because most of these children we have found, even to this day, their self-esteem suffers greatly because they're cognizant that they're working under a restraint. He was put on medication. We refused to let them put him on Ritalin because at that time there was a lot of controversy about Ritalin and seizures and what have you. Not only that, we were not inclined to let the school medicate him. We wanted to be in control of that. He was on Dexedrine. He responded marvelously. We picked up the prescription from the psychiatrist's office. We kept it under lock and key. We were the only ones who could give it to him. He graduated from high school, couldn't handle college, joined the Marine Corps, structured discipline, worked marvelously. He was in the Marine Corps for 6 years, got out of the Marine Corps, just kind of floundered around, still has the problem.
So he's 45 years old now, and yes. He's on medication for the
yes.
problem now.
He's on Vyvanse And I think they had put him on, the psychiatrist had put him on Adderall, and that was not effective for him. And this new medication, Vyvanse, seems to be working for him. But I was interested in finding out from your medical people there, how many of these children who are diagnosed with ADHD go on to have adult ADHD and to the extent that they need medication?
That's a great question, Paula. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Dr. Kalarje?
It is a great question. I think the field is kind of trying to answer it. So it depends on how you try to go about studying that question. So the numbers vary between 5 to 10% to 50% of kids who or of individuals who had ADHD as kids kind of continuing to have it as adults. And some people actually dispute that, saying that it's even an underestimate. So it's a complicated question, and the field is really putting a lot of effort trying to define symptoms ADHD that would be specific to adults, because at this point, like today, we make the diagnosis of ADHD in adults just like we make it in kids. And, you know, everybody would agree this is not very appropriate, because, you know, you wouldn't expect necessarily adults to jump on seats, you know, to receive that diagnosis. And yet they can still be pretty impaired from ADHD.
We have an email from Sydney in Des Moines. She wants to know if premature infants are at higher than normal risk of developing ADHD.
Unfortunately, they are, but that's kind of a global answer. You really have to look at what kind of complications they might have had, following prematurity, how premature they are, because prematurity, I mean, can go from anywhere between week 24 and week 38 of gestation, and what kind of treatment they had to receive immediately after birth.
Okay, well, her son right now is a year old. So if with a child that young, you're probably not seeing signs, but what does she need to look for as he gets older?
My personal feeling would be, don't worry about looking for symptoms. If there is a problem, it's going to be apparent. And if it's apparent, that's what we were talking about earlier, socially, academically, in terms of how he behaves at home, how compliant, or, you know, how much he minds what you ask him to do. I mean, all of these things will jump at you. If he wakes up one day and throws a fit, that doesn't necessarily mean he has ADHD.
One of the things that I think a lot of people are confused by with children who get a diagnosis of ADHD, or if they get, you know, a note home from school saying your child has a difficult time focusing, we need to do a time on task test, and, you know, we think that there may be a problem here. They'll think, but, you know, when my child is at home and they play a video game, they can play a video game for 3 hours, and now they're saying that at school this child can't focus for more than 5 minutes. There seems to be a real disconnect there. And you say it's because of the way that kids interact with video games.
Yes, I've never played a video game, so I need to say that. However, I know how they work. And the way they work is they give a feedback, whether it's a reward or a punishment, that's instantaneous. You don't have to wait 2 hours or 3 months to pass a test. It's immediate. And in that sense, they force an individual, a child or an adult, to be actively engaged continuously. We have, in a very simplistic way, we have two systems in our brain that keep us alert. One that's driven by I want, and the other one is I like. And so I want is the planning one. That seems to be more impaired in ADHD, and that's what is required for someone to sit in class because they want to graduate or to do well on their exam. On the other hand, I like is what the system that's kind of reinforced by these video games, and it's as powerful to keep someone engaged and address their attention problems. And actually, some non-medication interventions have tried to use that system to engage kids and improve their attention, and they work. They're just not very easy to implement.
Well, and of course, there have been links seen between too much time spent with media like video games or television and a coincidence with higher levels of ADHD. Do you think that this is a causal relationship?
I'm not an expert in this, so you know, I cannot really give a professional and well-informed opinion. I'm aware of that finding, mm-hmm. those findings. The problem is, it's a kind of chicken and egg kind of problem. So it's really difficult to draw causal mm-hmm. inferences from observational studies where they just find an association. But I know there is effort to look at these questions kind of over time, prospectively, to see whether indeed there is a causal relationship.
I've also heard speculation that we've created this with all of our technology. We've created a world environment that is so stimulating, and school is really very much like it has been for many years. So in many ways, we have these children who have this constant stimulation from video games and other things that can bring them this instant gratification, and school is still very much sitting and listening. So we've created two very different worlds that children need to try to inhabit. Dr. Troutman, when you work with kids with your therapy, do you find that there is a disconnect between how they're living and the time that they spend at school and the different attention needs there?
The question about video games and things like that comes up it comes up all the time in terms of parents talking about, well, they can pay attention to things that they really like. And the way I think of it is that it's part of the, just like Dr. Kalarji said, it's part of the deficit that they have in terms of how their brains work, and that they are, they're looking for things that sort of make up for their difficulties in paying attention. And so I think they do gravitate to things like video games where they really can, you know, get a lot of reinforcement.
In kind of answer also to your question about what we've done as a society, I mean, that's the same problem with obesity. It's because of the nature of the food we eat now, which is different from 300 years ago. But the question at the end of the day, as a parent, what society would you like your child to live in? If you want them to live in the 21st century, these are the this is the environment, whether you like it or not. You really would like your child to have optimal ability to function and excel. And that's what I, you know, tell the patients I see. It's not, as a general kind of societal-based question, we might raise issues like this. I mean, is this the best environment or not? But at the level of a family who's trying to make a decision, do I treat or not, whether medications or otherwise, they would like their child, I'm sure, to function at their best. And in that sense, we need to offer them the best we can.
Even thinking about getting tested for ADHD, I think, brings up a lot of conflicting emotions in parents. And of course, as parents, we all blame ourselves for everything bad that happens to our kids. So not only are you dealing with personal guilt and fear, but also with a lot of societal pressures and the judging that goes along with treating your child in any particular way. So I'd love to know from each of you what you would like parents who may be dealing with this issue to know and to understand. Dr. Troutman?
I think one thing I want them to know is just that, is to sort of trust their opinion and to trust their instincts, that if they think something is wrong, to look for help. And if they don't get the answers that if they don't get things that help them, to keep looking. Because we know so much more about how to help kids with ADHD than we did when I went to school.
Dr. Kalarji?
I would second that. Just keep looking, because even if you tried one intervention, it didn't work, try another one. Because we know, at least with medications, most kids will end up responding. Without medications, many kids will at least respond partially.
Dr. Shadi Kalarje is a child psychiatrist and associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. Dr. Beth Troutman is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry, also at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.